Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Who's on the line?
Hi, this is Jesse from Florida.
Hi, this is Miriam from New York. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Okay. I'm good. Are you hearing any high-pitched sounds yet?
No, not yet.
Okay. I only heard it when he was talking, while the facilitator was talking. I didn't hear it when anybody else was talking.
Yeah. This is Megan, and you know, it was on the, I listened to the recording as well, and it was on the recording too.
Extremely annoying. I hope it's fixed.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Megan, where are you from?
I'm from Tennessee.
Oh, well, hi. How's the weather there?
Well, it's 54 degrees right now. Tomorrow we're going to have sunny and 66. So,
oh, that sounds
pretty good.
It's freezing here. Freezing.
Oh, no. What's it like in New York?
Like in the 30s?
Oh, I'm originally from New York State, so I have been there many, many years.
Right. Is that the winter in Tennessee? Is that what it's usually like?
No, it seriously goes from anywhere to 15 degrees to 70 degrees based on,
really?
You know, whichever way the wind is blowing. Yeah.
Well, welcome, everybody. I'm impressed with your promptness and the number of you who actually were here before time. So welcome. It's great. Thank you also for your responses to the two questions. I appreciate that. I will take each of your questions and responses into account and incorporate that in the discussion rather than segmenting them as a response at the beginning of the session. I definitely will recognize the questions and incorporate that. I'm going to abbreviate. My dilemma personally is I would much rather have a seminar with, you know, give and take and discussion and that sort of thing, but there's so much I want to share with you, so much information that I think is vital that I just have to abbreviate that. So are there any comments or questions or clarifications just briefly now before we move into the material? There's a lot this evening, so strap your seatbelt. But any questions or comments?
Now, it's Miriam from New York. I just wanted to make a comment that one thing that really resonated and I thought was a really great expression of understanding this whole wellness coaching was when you said that a habit, you know, I think you said a habit is a routine that's repeated, and I really like that.
Yeah, and if, you know, I consider many, many things that a client says as coachable moments, which I mentioned is why I have an agreement with a client or ask permission, may I interrupt you at any point if I think something
right.
might be useful to talk about and give them permission. And if someone indicates something that they do as a part of an identity, as if that's what they, well, I'm just a procrastinator, I'm just a whatever, I interrupt them at that moment because it's harder to change something if you see it as an identity rather than a collection of repetitions, a habit, something
right.
that's a choice. So everything.
Oh, that's
that,
what it was. A habit is a choice that's repeated. That was your exact, right.
Yeah.
Habit
okay,
is a choice
great.
That's repeated.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Miriam. Any other thoughts or comments?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to move into the material, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to have just a little bit of time at the end. So if there are any questions, jot them down. And I'm hoping that the the glitch has been resolved. Do I sound better?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay, yes. Good. Good. Yeah, my apologies for that. Okay. We've discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. Now we're going to look closely at how to do that, how to facilitate doing that with your clients and yourself, at the principles and practice of change. We'll examine the 7 steps of the roadmap system to create a new wellness story. These 7 steps, the roadmap is an acronym. These 7 steps are a deconstruction of the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. It's a way of applying psychology, neuroscience, behavioral economics, and healthcare with strategic coaching. It's a system of understanding and stepwise change that creates a focus then on a wellness story. Now, this same process, this same 7 steps can be on any story, life story, career story, money story, relationship story. We're going to focus on wellness story and apply it in that way. So the roadmap for a new wellness story, the 7 steps: recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines. This is all in your outline and in the workbook. Map wellness, decide what to change, map wellness strategies, author new experiences, and finally, program a new identity. Now, every step is simple, but it's not necessarily easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it often requires us to change the way we think about our lives, such as breaking bad or simply outdated habits, developing new ones, remaining disciplined over the long haul. The first 3 steps are about awareness, a systematic way to ask questions of yourself or your clients. And in this seminar, we're going to cover the first 4 steps. So step 1, recognize authorship of your wellness story. Remember the premise. Each moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us, they're created by us. Yet so often the story closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past and ending an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. That means that you have to take 100% responsibility for your life. So, how can we tell our life and wellness stories to ourselves in order to know which aspects work and which need to change? So, first, 4 principles in recognizing authorship. Principle 1, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and results in life. Our beliefs, not all of them are conscious, certainly, our beliefs write the software of our behavior. Here's an example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a very small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. The baby elephant then stays in the area determined by the length of the rope. When this elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, it could easily break the rope, but it doesn't, because earlier, as a baby, it couldn't. This 6-ton adult elephant is constrained by the assumption based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines the elephant's behavior. I know I'm going to have to pick a new example soon because Ringling Brothers is disbanding, so my story will be a little dated, but I'll find a new one. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle 2, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. the beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process. We construct our storylines from these premises. So we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time and listen carefully to the beliefs of our clients and highlight them and look at them together. We don't get what we want. We get what we expect. We always make our beliefs come true. We act in such a way to teach people how to respond to us. This actualizes our beliefs and validates our assumptions. Principle 3, a new story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's intentions, you affect their behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer, because once they've made a commitment out loud, they tend to live into it. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the possibility of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates in the next 3 months by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat healthier foods, to exercise. So, state your intentions. Be specific. Write them down. Get a witness or an accountability partner. The stated intention is more powerful when it's coupled with a specific action plan. Henry Ford said, you can't build a reputation on what you're going to do. Principle 4, our minds seek closure and infer causality whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. These findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reasons that they do what they do, but when they're asked for a reason, they'll readily give one, because it's whatever makes sense consciously and logically that's found something tangible to light on. To create a complete story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete can even trump accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth, a finish without an ending. Now, I recommended, remember in the beginning, that you do the exercises for each of the segments that we're going to cover in the seminar. So hopefully you've done the exercises for the first four steps, or at least looked at them. I'd suggest now particularly reviewing the exercise in step one, recognize authorship of your story. It's on page 1.5. Plot includes the core themes and storylines of life stories that inform what we look for and then how we attribute meaning. And our storylines are our self-statement. Our wellness story is our self-statement. It's our construction. It doesn't exist until you write it, until you create it. Step two, in other words, the essence of recognizing authorship is to recognize that you create whatever you think and feel and experience, that whatever you experience, you either create or accept, so that you can't determine what someone else does, but you can determine 100% of what you do, and whatever you're creating is what you're authoring, whether or not it seems that way. So this is sometimes a challenge for some clients. Step two, own your story once recognizing it. And for here, I'd suggest reviewing the assumptions and motivations constructing storylines. That begins on page 1.7 in the workbook. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the already million bits of data that we process daily, like adding a new diet or adding a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. So, as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think will be useful. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to exercise 6 days a week. Limiting beliefs also influence reality and behavior. Limiting beliefs have an effect emotionally, physically. For example, I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. Notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. So first you have to experience what you do as a choice rather than just the way things are. So a fundamental precept of step two, own your story. Again, whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that notion by talking about two things, point of reference and active versus passive, two components of story that I think are really important and can be important in listening to the story of your client. The point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. They transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They may react to situations they're in. Here are some typical characteristics of those with an external point of reference. Another way to say this, here's a list of coachable moments. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them from responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. Now, some of these examples are way too easy for me to say. When they experience a symptom in their bodies, they medicate it away. That's like turning off the warning light on the dash of your car when it says service engine or something's the matter. Now, contrast that. Those with an internal point of reference, what we coach toward, they see their authority as their own. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. Their theme is effectiveness. They experience mastery. They know that, at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. Here are some of those characteristics. They recognize accountability for their lives. They are proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result, then look for alternatives. When they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. You know, that's the most basic premise that we have in mentor coaching. If it doesn't work, do something different. If it works, do more of it. They decide what to change and initiate that change. They also realize that the menu of choices is created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, here's a related notion. To recognize active versus passive positions. Sometimes the story may seem just to write itself, to just happen, if you look at it in a passive way. Well, I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. It just seems to keep happening. Or my anxiety stopped me, or my doubt paralyzed me. Remember the examples from last seminar. And each of these are passive notions that whatever choice or action we create, it's as if it just happened rather than creating it. So, coachable moment, you have to eliminate all the outs. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. So, once recognizing and owning your wellness story, step three, assess the storylines and plot. First, and these are the two exercises that you have on 1.12 and 1.14, distinguish and address ideals and distinguish and address needs. These are the two exercises that I almost always request a new client to take a few moments and fill out at the very beginning of our work, because I want to be sure that we're both clear about their core needs and their ideals so that we can use that to incorporate it in the strategy and goals and planning that we do together to create the success map. And I will ask that client to tell me their top three ideals and top three needs, and I'll put them inside the folder for that client so it's always accessible. Ideals and needs are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of self. Ideals serve as a personal model of value. It's an internal guide to purpose. The only place that I know that self-esteem comes from is having an attainable internal ideal and living up to it. Not living up to it results in shame. A need is an essential requirement, a necessity for mind, body, or spirit. So these two exercises, I think, are really important. It might be interesting for you to do them yourself. Pick your top three needs, top three ideals, and see what that tells you, if it crystallizes any awareness, and to be sure that those are aligned with goals and strategy. So part of the assessment of your wellness story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them. We just assume that we see things the way they are. So the brain has a mind of its own, and we are of two or more minds. For example, the prefrontal cortex says, well, let's set up an exercise program and plan a saving strategy. And the limbic system says, let's have that cheesecake and order the big screen HDTV. Each struggle is perhaps over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it, or the same energy or the same time. One of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from others' experiences as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them, examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well or to see if they need to be updated. In your wellness story, is all of you going the same direction? Do all of the storylines of your wellness story advance the plot? So, listen to your self-statements. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you attribute to others, another person, a group, or culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside, so pay attention to what you consistently like or dislike in another. Don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. And to listen for repetitions of the old story. Recognizing and owning your story is necessary. It's prerequisite to assessing changes. And remember this, whatever remains unconscious will most likely be attributed to fate. We're always reaching our goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious, so it's helpful to recognize consciously, specifically, what they are. So this is what the roadmap system is designed to do, is to look at deconstructing a story, to be aware of how a story is constructed, how you put it together, and what the assumptions and beliefs are. Remember, we talked about 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. So this is a way of making more and more of those elements conscious so that we can do more of what works, and if something doesn't work, do something else. We're always reaching our goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious, so it's helpful to know specifically what those goals are. For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self, for example, of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. And remember, it has to be your body in current time. It can't be your body 25 years ago. We'll talk more about the art and science of how to structure a visualization. And there's a visualization exercise in the addendum. It's actually a chapter from my book that I've included in the addendum about Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual. It's about the old art and the neuroscience of visualization. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says there's not full commitment. It's potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. You know the words of someone not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction by not being totally committed, by creating an out. When someone says, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. So the first time a client says, I'm going to try, I will usually quote one of my favorite wise people of the 20th century, try not, do or do not, there is no try. That was Yoda. So build in accountability by asking, by when? Our SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end for time. And we'll goals are on page 3.4. We'll get there. We're not there yet. So also listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, when you work out and rest well, at the time, especially later. A huge, delicious dessert will taste great at the moment, but the residual feeling and awareness of regret will last far longer than the few minutes of immediate pleasure of the great taste. Also reflect on what studies and your experience shows. The major taste impact, up to 80%, is in the first 3 bites anyhow. After that, it's redundant. Your body's already accommodated to the sensation. Listen to your body. Acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Acknowledge what works and what doesn't work. Hear your body speak when you eat too much, when you eat foods that are unhealthy, or drink too much. It's not rocket science. Listen to your body. It's sensitive, accurate, immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message, yet importantly, it is the message. And when you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. Symptoms give disguised voice to what you avoid knowing. A symptom is a sentinel of a process that begs to be understood, listened to rather than silenced, respected rather than disregarded. A storyline needing to be heard, a symptom repeats until it's translated or traumatic language is literal. A pain in the neck, purging something, churning gut, weeping skin, hypertension. A psychological symptom answers a question not dared ask consciously and proffers a story with its own history, dynamics, and meaning. Melrai Paddock put it very simply, it's easier to fall ill than learn the truth. So take care of your maladies. They always have something to tell you. You are the author, not the victim of your symptom. So let's discuss step four. Decide what to change. We're going to talk about change and how to do it. What I'd suggest that you have as reference is the first exercise of Module 2, four basic inquiries for storyline evaluation. That's on workbook page 2.4. Also, have the exercise 15 reflections to understand your storyline. That's workbook page 2.10. Those are two crucial exercises that I think will help crystallize an awareness of what to change. Now, here's a precept for this step, decide what to change. Part of the struggle for people to embrace change is difficult because the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to how the mind and the brain work. So what we're doing is looking specifically at understanding how the mind and brain work and creating ways to change that are consistent with that. Despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, having all the information and knowing what to do, many people don't make changes even when they know it's in their best interest. Your identity is not your behavior or habits. Again, a habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will be harder to change. People become the stories of who they think they are or believe they are. Remember the principle from step two. In adulthood, you either create your reality or agree to it. For this, you have to recognize and own your wellness story. So let's look at what's involved in deciding to change. Let's look specifically at how the brain opposes change. I believe this is crucial to understand when we engage change in ourselves and in our clients. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. The cognitive sciences inform how to change a personal or business story. Let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then use this information to facilitate success. And remember, when you feel with one side of the brain and think on the other, you need a map. Since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider 10 precepts, 10 principles of how our brains work. Each of these, I believe, will help you in guiding someone to write a new wellness story. The mechanisms are a little complex, but the principles are so simple they're almost elusive. One, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired into the brain. Whenever we do something in a repeated way, our brain creates new neuronal networks and pathways to ultimately make it automatic so that it's energy efficient and it becomes the default mode. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about how to drive us to work the same way each day. Because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is so energy efficient, it frees the brain up to do other things. The brain is amazingly adaptive. It's made routine behaviors energy efficient by creating hardwiring and growing new neurons for that purpose. Now, when these habits are confronted and have to change, the basal ganglia in the midbrain where the automatic pilots are get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process the thinking, to figure out new ways of doing something. So what this means is it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change because hardwiring behavior saves energy, so it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode, but the brain doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. I've heard Ray Kurzweil say this, and he spoke of it in his book, The Singularity is Near When Humans Transcend Biology. He said, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations we can perform without thinking about them. So, number two, how our brains oppose change. Change creates dissonance. So, couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to see what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. We do this by screening information based on expectation as validation. So out of the millions of bits of data that are possible for us to perceive each day, we see what's been encoded already as possibility. And we do this by screening expectations. When people don't see what they expect to see, it actually activates the brain's error detection mechanism, and it reads as if something's wrong. The error detection mechanism is an actual part of the brain located right next to the emotional center of the brain. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors. That's the difference between expectation or the usual routine and perceived actuality when it's different. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. And at times it can be abrupt and explicit. Remember the experience of absent-mindedly going to the refrigerator, getting a drink of milk, and wham, you discover that it was a sip of orange juice. When this happens, neural firings disrupt expected flow and use brain energy. So the reason I'm emphasizing this is exactly what your client will experience when your client tries something new or different. There's going to be universally, ubiquitously, every client trying something new, that client will experience discomfort and uncertainty and trepidation and anxiety because they haven't done it before and it's new and different. They've departed that superhighway of the familiar in their brain to take that machete and to try something new. So their read is an immediate discomfort. Now, here's where we come in, both to empathically resonate with that discomfort and to help reframe it. Because if a client interprets it as in an old model that anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, then it makes sense to stop and go back to what he was doing normally. That immediately treats the anxiety. Or if a client reads this discomfort as, you know, my gut is telling me this isn't the right thing to do, or my intuition says that I'm just off the mark here. I think I'm going to listen to my intuition. So what we can do to help a client reframe is that's an inaccurate assessment to attribute it to intuition, that it's understandable that there's uncertainty or trepidation because something is new or different. It will get comfortable, but it will take time. But that uncertainty, that trepidation, is validation that you're in new territory. It's a signpost of proceeding. So that reframes it as an internal validation of progress rather than a signal to go back to the familiar. So this is what I'm going to return to again and again about how we help someone internalize the change and evolve their own internal model of how they see themselves, because this is the P, the last step of the roadmap, programming new identity. When external changes occur, we need to help a client incorporate and internalize that as part of an evolving model, of an evolving and transforming identity of who they are now, rather than in an old model. That's what makes change permanent. The most powerful force of the human psyche is to return to the familiar. And if the familiar is the old identity, then there may be a change, but soon enough somebody will return. This is why people return to their default habits. This is why somebody loses significant weight and 95% return to gain back that weight, because they haven't changed their core identity, their true body self, their body image. That identity is important. That operating model is crucial to change. So, the good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors, to optimize behavior. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished rewards. So we use this mechanism to respond to mistakes. And that's important if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or simply a neural response and print out to change itself. So that's the important distinction here. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. I'd like you to write down some numbers if you have a pen. Write these numbers down. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? A usual example is maybe 3 and 6, maybe multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head, informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a third rise will follow. Extrapolation has been called the most common mistake in investing, when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty said, there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how brain repetition pattern is also the basis of jokes. Listing 2 things and then a third non sequitur. Set up, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. This is what we're seeing when we see behavior patterns and attachment patterns that our clients repeat without even being aware of them, attachment patterns that have been there from early on. And this is sort of this is some of the process that we also want to be aware of, but that's a matter for a different seminar series. We need to be sure we predict or envision the right things. Number 4 for how the brain opposes change. Behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. Both are going to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short-term but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. This is the principle that we talked about, recall, that we get what we focus on, not what we want. If we focus on reversing something negative, that's still a negative focus. We get what we focus on. Now, we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. Or our clients would not need us, only the internet, because there's lots of information on the internet. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. The error detection mechanism says, avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. I work with pro athletes and actors. They are not motivated to get up and go to the gym each day. The athletes in off season, the performance professionals year round. They are not motivated to do that most likely. But they do it simply because they know it's what they need to do in order to do what's next. You do not need to be motivated to do something. All you need is a plan and to stick to it. How many coaching sessions have you heard? I've heard a bunch in training that began with, you know, I just need to get motivated to lose some weight. I need to get motivated to exercise. I need to get motivated to save some money. It won't happen that way. That's like learning to swim on paper before you jump in the pool. It doesn't work that way either. You have a plan, and you stick to it. That's all that's required. 6, emotions change brain functioning. Anxiety or fear shifts someone into a survival mode that prevents fluid learning and understanding. The alarm signals of fear, anxiety, anger, even just irritability and impatience can shanghai the attention of the frontal lobes, causing them to forfeit optimum functioning. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals are released that prompt toward action, away from creativity and even away from assessing knowledge, and sometimes simply block certain thought processes. So this is why regulation of states of mind is a key, I would say the key success factor in dealing with people. And that's a matter of a whole other seminar series too, and I'm sorry I don't have time to go more into that. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short term actually enhance learning. The time window on this is about 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, with stress, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. That means with sustained stress, people can make bad and emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy is regulation of states of mind and managing emotions. Because under stress, we do two things. We regress to an earlier mode, and then we also hyper-focus on the most recent events and lose the big picture. 8, for how the brain opposes change, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position get most entrenched. This is our challenge as coaches, to open a closed system, to empathically challenge, to strategically perturbate that closed system. Now, these last two principles, I think, are absolutely huge for coaching. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, creating new brain cells: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is one of intellectual and emotional stimulation. it creates more complex brain structure and a greater number of cells in the hippocampus. That's what we do with our clients, co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bus, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And again, the hippocampus, primary site of creativity and memory. Recently, these findings, same number, range, were replicated in humans in non-invasive studies in London taxicab drivers and medical students at the University of Hamburg. Another related finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus associated with creativity and memory decrease with chronic stress. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, for stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm, the traditional therapy was to put the arm in the sling to prevent damage. When the opposite was done, when the good arm was put in the sling, so they were forced to use the bad arm to do things like feeding and dressing, after 10 days of this consistent therapy, the patients regained significant use of an arm that thought would always be useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. Another example, not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate the body part claims can be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert braille reader has significantly greater area handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same with a classical guitarist for the dominant hand. Now, the good news, we're not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways, and new neural networks are formed. New highways to new communities in your brain. And some remarkable new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So I'd suggest you review two exercises in particular. The personal feedback assessment, page 2.5. It's an adaptation of the 3-6 degrees business tool, which is designed to get external feedback. This is designed for internal feedback. And reflections to understand your storyline, page 2.10, designed also for internal feedback. So here's a summary of what neuroscience teaches us about change to apply to your wellness story and to your clients. One, everyone, this is all in your outline, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. Two, prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. In other words, a belief or a fact is a physical reality in the brain. You can't just present a new fact and expect it's going to override what's already there. But it's an inside job that can change and be transformed as a process such as coaching. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. That's why fixing doesn't work. That's why giving answers doesn't work. You can't just list the four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. Four, partly because it's complex and partly because it's subjective reality, which is kind of redundant, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. Since prior knowledge is concrete, it's an actual pathway in the brain, you have to begin where you are to solidly understand your story in order to see what to change. So, here are some specific ways listed, 11 ways to facilitate change of mind, brain, and behavior. One, begin where the client is. Two, help them learn more about what they already know. Three, highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents or behaviors or patterns or what works to encourage the practice. Four, don't focus on mistakes. Remember, focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Five, correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Six, let both sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lie. Seven, encourage the client to develop his or her own metaphor and connections. Stories, analogies, and metaphors are maps in the brain. Eight, the brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. Nine, you have to recognize and take ownership of your experience and story. 10, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. 11, give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. A series of small, specific steps strategically planned is more effective than a one-time intensive training, unless there are follow-up programs. This is part of what we do in coaching to think about shrinking the change. Let me give you an example of what I'm saying. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a coach. They went to an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals. They visualized, wrote affirmations, worked very hard and focused and collaborated in a remarkable way. After a few hours, one penguin had a breakthrough and flew a short distance. Others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. If there are any thoughts, questions, or just clarifications about what we've talked about. I know that was a lot of stuff, and it will be in the recording if there are parts you want to listen to again. But any clarifications or comments about what you've heard? We have maybe 4 or 5 minutes. Is this making sense to you so far? To begin
Absolutely.
To think about applying it as we listen and work with clients.
Absolutely.
Okay. Clarifications or
yeah.
questions about any aspect of it? Hey, one application of the notion that we have and what we know from neuroscience that whenever we have a fact or a belief that it's an anatomical reality in the brain, that we can't just introduce a new fact or tell somebody what to do and expect that they're going to do it, because that doesn't change brain architecture. It doesn't change the neuronal pathways and networks and the patterns of what someone engages in. That's why we have to begin with where the client is. And that often is, what is the challenge to the client? What do they see that they experience a challenge? That's where we can engage them. You know, think about it in this way. This is from a seminar series that I do on the psychology of influence, the neuroscience of persuasion, and neuromarketing. Draw a circle. Just draw a circle on the page. Inside that circle, put a stick figure. Now, that stick figure is your client. As long as you're outside that circle, that client is not really going to listen to you or pay attention to you. Your challenge is to get inside that circle. Once inside the circle, you have a collaborative alliance with that client. The best way, usually, to get inside that circle is to look at what is the challenge that that client has that the client can't do or be himself or herself. What is it that they will pay you money to help them do or be that they can't do themselves? What is their challenge? What is their pain point? When you resonate with that, that begins a new story. There are three parts of a story: the challenge, the struggle, and the resolution. The middle part is what you do in coaching to get the client to where the client wants to be. But first, you have to get inside the circle. You can't introduce a way of suddenly changing someone's mind and brain outside the circle or by beginning with where the client isn't. You have to get in and resonate with the client's experience to create a common ground together so that you can go someplace new. Then you're in a collaborative alliance, and that's what characterizes coaching as distinct from all the other professions. Every other profession is based on a consultative model. You go to a doc, a dentist, an attorney, a financial consultant, a CPA. You present an issue, a problem, and they ask you some questions, and they give you an answer about what you need to do, a specific recommendation. That's not what we do in coaching. What we do is enter a collaboration to co-create a new story together. And the point of reference will be the client and the co-creation of the client story. We're not ghostwriting that story, telling the client what to do, but we're helping the client develop that story. That's what makes it powerful. That's what makes change that lasts. And that's what we're looking at in the roadmap system, is how to understand and help someone evolve to a new story. That's what makes a change that lasts. Well, again, I welcome any questions or thoughts that any of you send in an email. I will definitely take them into account, and I have them, the ones that have been sent so far, I have them beside me, and I promise I'll get to them and incorporate it in a discussion. So I welcome any correspondence that you have, and okay. We'll pick up right here next time. I'd recommend that you do the exercises prior to our seminar so that you'll have an even better grasp of what I'm trying to talk about and hopefully can be clearer about. So thanks very much.
Okay.
And I will look forward to picking up right here next time. Have a great rest of the week. Bye now.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Bye.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye.